I'm Samir Patel, editor-in-chief at Quanta Magazine. Our mission at Quanta is to cover what we call basic or fundamental research in science and math. That means the kind of work that's driven by curiosity and discovery and the search for knowledge. We're interested in how and why everything around us works the way that it does. On our brand new show, the Quanta Podcast, you'll meet the writers and editors behind the magazine, and together we'll explore the biggest ideas and the tiniest details. Join me for the Quanta Podcast, your weekly dispatch from the frontiers of science and math.
The U.S. is signaling that it's ready to strike Iran. Even if it's just posturing, there will likely still be consequences.
Every war game that I have been involved in Washington for many years has ended in a grisly way.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, what we know about Washington's intentions and Iran's capacity for retaliation. Also in Venezuela, jailed dissidents are being released, but many in exile cannot return. The ruling party says they wish opposition leaders could come home.
Ojalá incluso hubiese manera de
but they have to say they're sorry.
Plus, one country's all-too-rare success making the shift to green energy.
The transition is possible.
And a jazz pianist in New York serenades his native Ukraine.
That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being with us today. Officials from Iran and the U.S. are set to sit down for another round of talks in Geneva tomorrow. The two sides are negotiating a deal to limit Iran's nuclear program. Iran's foreign minister said yesterday that his country is willing to make major concessions.
Meanwhile, U.S. warships are surrounding the Islamic Republic. With the military buildup suggesting a possible U.S. attack on Iran in the near future, the world's Shirin Jafari starts us off today with a look at how Iran might retaliate.
Last June, U.S. jets flew over the skies of Iran, taking down one military site after another. B-2 bombers dropped 30,000-pound bombs on Iran's nuclear facilities. Satellite images showed damage. President Trump announced that they had been obliterated. But today, once again, U.S. warships and jets surround Iran. This military buildup is the largest since the start of the Iraq War in 2003.
This conflict has a higher potential than at any other point in the region's recent history of turning into a regional conflagration.
Ali Waez is with the International Crisis Group. He says Iran's military capabilities were hit in the summer, but that doesn't mean Iran cannot respond. The country's military might is nowhere close as that of the U.S., but it has other ways of inflicting pain, he says. Iranian officials have said in recent days that if attacked, they will target U.S.'s bases in the region. The U.S. has troops based in neighboring countries like Qatar and Bahrain. They can also target U.S.'s allies like Saudi Arabia. Waez says Iran can spread the conflict to other places in the region.
Targeting shipping in the Persian Gulf, energy exports out of the Straits of Hormuz in order to jack up the energy prices and create an inflationary impact in the United States that could hurt President Trump politically.
Russia and China have provided some military aid to Iran, Waez says, including the chemicals Iran needs to fuel its ballistic missiles. They've also helped Iran with radars and electronic warfare. But at the end of the day, he says, Iran can't rely on these countries to come to its help.
If war breaks out, Russia and China are likely to only send their thoughts and prayers to the Iranians and not go to the country's rescue.
But Iran has been planning for a war with the U.S. and Israel for a long time, says Alex Vatanhah. He's with the Middle East Institute in Washington. Iran has a robust domestic drone and missile production program. It has even helped Russia with drones in its war in Ukraine. But for Iran, this conflict will be different than the one from last summer, he says.
This is the first time they're fighting essentially a two-front war. One is against external adversaries, in this case, United States, probably Israel. But more importantly is the Iranian public.
Since last month, protesters have come out to the streets demanding regime change. The Iranian security forces responded by killing thousands. Vatanhah says the Iranian leaders find their backs to the wall because of these two fronts. And that makes the situation even more unpredictable.
If they're in a place where they have nothing to lose because their survival literally is at stake, they might act in ways we haven't seen Iran act before.
Nicole Graevsky teaches at Sciences Po in Paris and is a fellow with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She says Iran's response will also be determined by the scope of the U.S. attack. She says Iran has historically relied on its proxies like Hezbollah, Hamas, and militias in Iraq to come to its help. But they are not what they used to be before the October 7th attack on Israel.
Hezbollah's leadership took a massive hit in the kind of escalation between Israel and Lebanon. But there are remnants of it, and there's, you know, indications that Hezbollah is trying to reconstitute.
Iran has also threatened to mine the Strait of Hormuz, the waterway that is critical for global energy. Demining can take a long time. Graevsky says she's watching to see if diplomatic and non-essential staff in the region are evacuated. The U.S. has already told its embassy staff in Lebanon to leave. In his State of the Union speech last night, President Trump said that he prefers to make a deal with Iran. But he said the Iranians haven't said the magic words. The magic words are that they won't make any nuclear weapons. Iranian leaders, including the Supreme Leader himself, have stated that the country is not pursuing nuclear weapons. The country's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, repeated that yesterday in a social media post. Alex Vatanha of the Middle East Institute says so much of what is on display now is about national pride, both in Iran and in the U.S.
That's the sort of almost scary and strange situation we find ourselves. So President Trump wants something that looks clear-cut win for him. And the Iranian Ayatollah does not want to be seen as the one who caved in because Donald Trump, you know, put on the military show at Iran's doorstep.
The substance of a nuclear deal agreement that both sides can live with is already there, he adds. But at this point, it's not just about that.
The world's Shirin Jafari there, explaining the high stakes in Iran right now for everyone involved. As part of her reporting for that story, she spoke with retired U.S. Army General David Petraeus about the prospect of all-out war between the U.S. and Iran. Petraeus also served as the director of the CIA. So, Shirin, thanks for sticking around and taking us a little deeper into Petraeus's thinking. One thing I hope he has been thinking about is what the White House plan is, because despite all the military forces and hardware the U.S. has sent to the region, there is still no clarity on what it is all for. How does General Petraeus see it?
Yeah, exactly. And this is something that many are trying to figure out right now. Yesterday, the so-called Gang of Eight, which includes House and Senate leaders from both parties and leaders from the Intelligence Committee, met behind closed doors. Afterwards, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer told reporters that what he heard is a serious matter and that the president has to make his case regarding any potential military strikes on Iran. Overall, there seems to be a lot of head-scratching in Washington about where all this is headed. And that's exactly what General Petraeus told me when I asked him what he makes of the situation. General Petraeus also served in the army for almost four decades, and he commanded U.S. forces in the Middle East during the war in Iraq.
Well, it's hard to say because there hasn't been a public discussion of the specific objectives, but it appears that he's after a nuclear deal. And since he left the deal that was done by the Obama administration, it obviously would have to be better than that particular deal. And that's where the challenges come, I think, that I'm just not sure that this quite fundamental hardline supreme leader and his regime will be willing to agree to that kind of deal.
Yeah, so we have heard that a nuclear deal is part of this, but the main objective seems to be preventing Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. The U.S. attacked Iran this past summer, we should recall, and claimed that it had obliterated its nuclear facilities. Why is the U.S. threatening more attacks?
While the U.S. claims to have destroyed Iran's capabilities, Iran does still have nuclear technology. To General Petraeus, these follow-up threats from the U.S. and Israel are not completely unexpected.
I estimate that it set the program back a couple of years, noting that there is no guarantee that there's not a stockpile of highly enriched uranium and advanced centrifuges that could be further enriched to weapons grade.
Also, Shirin, as you said in your report, the military threat is coming at a time when the Iranian leadership is facing its most serious domestic opposition, a big protest there. President Trump promised to send help to the protesters. Realistically, can a military strike bring about regime change?
General Petraeus doesn't think so. He says it's highly unlikely that the U.S. will send any ground troops to Iran, and that's the extent to which President Trump is going to play a role here.
The World's Shirin Jafari, thank you for this deeper dive into General Petraeus' comments.
You're welcome, Marco.
Thirty-four Australian women and children recently released from a Syrian detention center are trying to get back to their native Australia. But so far, lawmakers in Australia have blocked their return, saying they pose a security risk because of suspected connections between them and the Islamic State. The Australians in question had been among more than 2,000 people from 50 different countries languishing at Al-Roj camp in Syria. The question of whether they should or should not be allowed back in their home country has sparked passionate debate in Australia. Daniel Lacerda joins us to explain the underlying tensions here. He's a reporter with the Sydney Morning Herald. Tell us about these 34 women and children, Daniel. How did they get to Syria in the first place?
The women came to Syria, came to the Middle East to join the so-called caliphate, or create the caliphate in the Middle East related to ISIS. While in Syria, some of them gave birth to children. Others brought their children over with them to the Middle East from Australia. So that's how they find themselves in northeast Syria today, trying to repatriate back home.
So these women and children all recently obtained Australian passports. Does that mean they are entitled by law to return home?
It does. Any Australian is entitled under law to return home. Of course, you need a passport to do that. They receive their passports from Syrian authorities after several years of delays and essentially prepared to come home. It's just a matter of getting themselves to Damascus, getting their papers in check, and getting on that plane. However, as you mentioned in your intro, there are some snags that are appearing as they attempt that repatriation.
Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese recently appeared on an Australian broadcasting company news show where he defended the country's efforts to prevent the women and children from returning. Here's how he explained the reasoning.
My mother would have said, if you make your bed, you lie in it. These are people who went overseas supporting Islamic State and went there to provide support for people who basically want a caliphate.
So that's the Prime Minister's description of the connection of these women to the Islamic State. How much is definitively known about that?
Not a lot is a short answer. We know that these women came over to the Middle East to either marry members of the Islamic State or went with their husbands who are related to the Islamic State. Obviously, there's 34 people in this group, so there's varying extents of potential radicalization or potential commitment to that cause.
Yeah, and it's not just Albanese's governing party that's concerned. Australian opposition leader Angus Taylor is seized on this issue. He's accused the governing Labour Party of doing everything except, quote, driving these people to the airport to support them returning to Australia. Here he is speaking to Sky News Australia.
We need to shut the door to people who are going to bring hate and violence to our shores from another part of the world. It also means that we'll shut the door to people who don't believe in our way of life, our core beliefs.
Daniel, this is not the first time Australia is dealing with this issue, but how is it landing now in Australia's political landscape?
Yeah, it's worth noting that Angus Taylor just came into the leadership of the opposition about 2 weeks ago, so this really is his first big battlefront. It's really, I suppose, struck a chord with the Australian people. You only have to think back to the Bondi Beach terror attack in December. Of course, that was inspired by Islamic State. In fact, it's really front of mind. Of course, these people are Australian and they are entitled to return home, provided they have a passport. Albanese has been careful to strike a quite careful tone in noting his contempt for these people, but also making clear, well, they are Australian and therefore they can return home, provided that they have all their documents in check.
We got to remember that some of these kids in these camps are already severely impacted, according to some news reports, deep fear, psychological trauma. Some of the mothers even say they're willing to send their kids back to Australia alone if the moms are not permitted entry. What's likely to happen next?
It's really hard to tell what will happen next. Yes, there has been some media reports suggesting that some women would want the children to come home first. I'm not sure that's likely. Again, all these people, given that they're Australian, are entitled by law to come home. And of course, a lot of these young children, it's probably in everyone's best interest for them to be with their mothers.
Do you get the sense, eventually in Australia, that there will be some kind of consensus about the future of these women and children?
I'm not optimistic of that, to be honest. I think there is a lot of rhetoric in the media from a lot of passionate figureheads on this. What is clear is that some Australian states, especially the ones on the East Coast, have been planning for their return for some time now. Some women and children came back 4 years ago. So there are measures in place, contingency plans, I guess you could call them, to accommodate for these people should they return home. But in the meantime, it is a very hotly contested debate. And I don't necessarily see a consensus or a unifying position coming in the short term.
Daniel Losurdo is a reporter with the Sydney Morning Herald. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Artificial intelligence company Anthropic is reportedly in a standoff with the Pentagon over maintaining safeguards on the use of its AI tools by the military. That's according to unnamed sources speaking to multiple news outlets. The sources say the Pentagon has given Anthropic until Friday to give full access to its AI model or risk losing a $200 million defense contract. The government, they say, wants Anthropic's restrictions on AI-controlled weapons and surveillance lifted. Michael Horowitz worked on AI policies at the Pentagon during the Biden administration and is now a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Michael, what is this fight about? What exactly does the Pentagon want to be able to do that Anthropic will not allow?
This fight in some ways is a head-scratcher at the moment because it's really a fight about theoretical future use cases of Anthropic's technology,
okay,
rather than anything that the Pentagon is asking Anthropic to do at present. Anthropic was the first of the frontier AI labs to be willing to have its technology used on classified networks and has been very willing to expand that work with the Pentagon. So it's really unfortunate in some ways, you know, speaking from the perspective of someone that worked at the Pentagon, to, you know, to see this dispute erupt.
And so you said these are future hypothetical use cases, but is it accurate that they are around AI-controlled weapons and then government surveillance potentially in the future?
Absolutely. You know, those are the two things that have come up again and again in the reporting on this issue. And it reflects in some ways, at least based on my understanding, Anthropic's view that its technology isn't mature enough in some ways for those uses. Anthropic is the frontier AI lab that has been most vocal about the limitations of AI technology as well as its potential power to transform our society, and has been really nervous about potential misuse of its technology. And that seems to be at play here in the conversation with the Pentagon.
I understand you're saying this capability does not exist yet, but what exactly are we talking about here? Is this AI choosing a target to strike and then actually pulling the trigger?
So take the Maduro raid, which there's been public discussion of Anthropic technology being used in. Palantir is another contractor for the Pentagon, has a system called Maven Smart System, and Anthropic's technology is one of many plugins essentially into that system. And that system was reportedly used in the Maduro raid. And that's something that Anthropic was comfortable with. If the question then is using Anthropic's technology to do something like target an individual on the battlefield, that in some ways is another bridge, because it's the hardest possible thing that you could imagine an algorithm doing. And Anthropic thinks that its technology just isn't there yet. And frankly, I don't think they're wrong about that. The kinds of algorithms that you would use for AI-enabled weapon systems are much more likely to be bespoke and trained on specific data sets for, you know, whatever you're trying to target, rather than a more general purpose model like the one that Anthropic develops.
Hmm. So is that capability already being employed with other technology?
You know, I think the Pentagon's working on weapon systems all the time. You know, I'm not there anymore. I don't know what's happening in the day-to-day. But I think the Pentagon is very aware that it's in fierce competition with China geopolitically in general, and specifically when it comes to AI leadership and military AI adoption. And so the Pentagon, from its side, is trying to ensure that it has access to all of the most sophisticated tools that American companies have to offer so that the American military can be as effective as possible.
When you were talking about the limitations just a second ago, were you basically referencing, you know, a drone, for example, an AI-powered drone, not being able to distinguish between, say, a civilian and a combatant?
It doesn't even need to be an AI-powered drone. It could be any kind of sensor. But the hardest possible thing that we could ask algorithms to do on the battlefield is distinguishing between an individual that's a lawful combatant and an individual that's not a lawful combatant. And so I'm not surprised at all that, you know, this is something that Anthropic thinks is a bridge too far for its technology at present. That's why most of the military AI use cases on the battlefield that we're talking about, and there are a range off the battlefield as well, tend to involve targeting material, you know, things like adversary tanks or adversary aircraft rather than individuals.
That is something that is currently being used?
That is something that is certainly in the range of the possible, and where there's been a lot of discussion about this in some ways as the next iteration of a lot of what we've seen Ukraine doing and Russia doing on the battlefield there.
How is AI being used on the battlefield in Ukraine right now?
You know, Ukraine has been an incredible innovator when it comes to the use of AI on the battlefield. They've used AI to try to improve their ability to process all of the intelligence information that you get. Imagine essentially thousands of drones out on the battlefield, all getting information about where Russian forces are and those feeding back in that information that are being processed to try to understand which are the highest value kinds of targets to hit.
We talk a lot about the promise and the peril of AI, and I think perhaps a lot of people listening to this conversation might be thinking about problems this type of technology could cause, especially if it's not in the right hands. What kind of guardrails or safeguards exist? Is there international law that governs the use of AI on the battlefield?
The international law that governs the use of AI on the battlefield is in some ways the same international law that governs the use of force in general, in that any use of force, whether it's a stick or a stone, a radar-guided missile, or some, you know, fancy AI weapon, needs to follow international humanitarian law with principles of distinction and proportionality. And there always needs to be a human responsible for the use of force. And that's one reason in some ways why this dispute between Anthropic and the Pentagon has seemed so unnecessary, since the Pentagon has to follow the law regardless. And specifically when it comes to the use of force, all uses of force have to have human responsibility for it. So in theory, at least, any use of force with Anthropic's tools would have to follow those regulations. So what we've really seen between Anthropic and the Pentagon is a breakdown in trust, where Anthropic is nervous that its technology will be used inappropriately, and the Pentagon is nervous Anthropic might back away from uses that it thinks are important for American national defense.
Back to this question about Anthropic and Pentagon and the spat they're in right now. What's the bottom line? Do you think how it resolves matters? Or if Anthropic does not give the Pentagon the capabilities that they want, will they just go to any of the other AI companies that they have contracts with to get those capabilities?
It would be a shame in a world where the U.S. is in such fierce AI competition with China for the Pentagon to lose access to the talent and technology that Anthropic brings to the table. You know, that being said, there are a number of frontier AI labs. The United States is fortunate to be the world's leader in AI innovation. And hopefully some of those companies could step in if worse comes to worse. But again, I want to emphasize that this dispute between the Pentagon and Anthropic really feels unnecessary, given that the Pentagon wants Anthropic to do more with them. Anthropic wants to do more with them, and reportedly as many in the Pentagon happy with the work that they're doing today. So from a national defense perspective, hopefully they can work it out.
Michael Horowitz worked on AI policies at the Pentagon during the Biden administration and is now a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Venezuela, tearful reunions have been taking place outside prisons. Activists jailed under the regime of Nicolas Maduro are being released thanks to an amnesty law that was signed last week by Venezuela's acting president. But dozens of imprisoned soldiers and exiled political leaders have been excluded from the deal. Reporter Manuel Rueda is in Caracas, where he's been speaking with some of the prisoners' families about what the new law means for Venezuela's future. Outside the Helicoide prison in Caracas, a group of activists in white shirts say a prayer and demand justice for those who are still in Venezuela's jails.
Justicia, justicia, justicia y libertad.
Most of the people here are the relatives of Venezuelan soldiers who have been accused of participating in various plots against Nicolás Maduro's government. They have not qualified for the amnesty, which is designed mainly for civilians who were arrested for leading anti-government protests.
Para nosotros como familiares de los militares presos,
for the relatives of imprisoned soldiers, this law has been a joke, a slap in the face, says Gloria Morales. Her son, Rosmel Mendez, has been in prison for 5 years, accused of participating in a plot known as Operation Gideon, in which a group of mercenaries and retired soldiers tried to capture Maduro after reaching Venezuela on small boats. Morales says that her son, a military police inspector, was caught because he was on a fishing trip close to where the assault took place. They got him barefooted, without any weapons on him, she explains. Despite the scant evidence, Mendez and several others who were accused of participating in the plot have been sentenced to 30 years in prison.
It's less about the crimes that these individuals may have done or not, and more about sending the message that dissent is not to be tolerated inside the military.
Geoff Ramsey is a Venezuela analyst at the Atlantic Council. He says that Venezuela's new government, which is run by Maduro's aides, is still trying to appease military officials who are not happy with the release of dissidents.
There is an internal culture within Venezuela's armed forces that is not kind to individuals who are accused of betraying the ruling party.
Many of Venezuela's exiled opposition leaders have also been excluded from the amnesty, so they could be imprisoned if they come home. A clause in the new law says that people who have supported or promoted attacks on Venezuela led by foreign powers don't qualify. Officials from Venezuela's ruling party say that includes opposition leader Maria Corina Machado. She issued several statements supporting the raid in which Maduro was captured.
Ojalá incluso hubiese manera de que se resuelvan todos los casos.
I wish there was a way for everyone to return, says Jorge Arriaza, a member of Venezuela's ruling party who helped design the amnesty law. He's speaking on national television.
Pero tendría que haber un acto de constricción.
But the exiles would need to ask for forgiveness and hold an act of contrition, he says. Pedro Urruchurtu, the international relations director for Machado's political party, says the government is just trying to ban those who beat them in the last election.
They are using this so-called law as a tool for avoid that the real opposition or the leadership who has a legitimacy could come back to the country and do politics on the ground.
Urruchurtu is wanted by Venezuela's authorities for terrorism and treason. To return to the country, he would need to ask a judge to rule whether he qualifies for amnesty and seek a pardon for his supposed crimes. He says that's not going to happen.
Because we are innocent people. That's simple. We don't have to recognize anything.
Ramsey says that exiles like Urruchurtu have limited leverage over Venezuela's government and its policies. Their ability to return to the country and participate in politics still depends largely on the Trump administration.
Eventually, I do think that Caracas is going to come under greater pressure from Washington on this issue after the U.S. is able to claim success for at least some kind of a modest economic recovery.
The Trump administration so far has been focusing on rebuilding Venezuela's oil industry, which he says would be a huge boost for the country. The president also wants to see big money investors coming back. Outside the Helicoide prison in Caracas, relatives of the jailed soldiers are now hoping for a pardon from Venezuela's president. They've been holding vigils to seek the freedom of their relatives for 47 consecutive days. I don't understand why the government will not release them, says Gloria Morales. But we will stay here, trusting that God does something for our cause. For the World, I'm Manuel Rueda, in Caracas.
And now for a few stories that you might have missed.
The Trump family has gotten the go-ahead to build what Eric Trump has called the nicest ballroom in Ireland. The approval has moved at a snail's pace, though, because of an actual snail. The 320-person hall at the Trump International Golf Club in Dunbeg was held up by the protected species known as Virgo angustior, a tiny brown snail that lives in marshy areas. The Trumps had to draw up a plan for safeguarding the snail during construction.
The members of K-pop band BTS have all completed their mandatory military service in South Korea, and their first concert post-service is coming up. If you are hoping for a ticket, though, you are out of luck. All 260,000 tickets have already been snapped up. The free concert next month will be in Seoul's Gwanghwamun Square, which will function as an open-air stadium. The show will launch the band's first new album in more than 4 years.
And finally, in Ghana, today is officially Fugu Wednesday. Fugu is a name for the country's traditional smock-like shirt. The new holiday was prompted by the Ghanaian president's recent visit to Zambia. The head of state wore a fugu, a sartorial choice that Zambians mercilessly mocked online. So the tourism minister, in an attempt to defend what he called Ghana's rich cultural heritage, is celebrating the fugu by renaming Hump Day in its honor.
And those are a few stories that you might have missed. In the late 2000s, the small South American country of Uruguay got about half of its electricity from fossil fuels. Within 7 years, that figure dropped to about 2%. Ramon Mendez Galine was the man who made that happen. He was the country's energy secretary at the time. Now he is trying to help other countries do something similar. I spoke with Galine for our latest installment of The Big Fix, where we dig into the most ambitious efforts to deal with climate change. I asked him whether his goal from the outset was to get the country off of fossil fuels.
Yeah, it was a conscious decision because, in fact, we don't have any kind of fossil fuels reservoir. So all fossil fuel we needed to use, we need to import it. So for us, going to renewables was having more energy sovereignty, energy independence. So it was just about the independence of the country itself. We're a small country, a small economy. So being independent was absolutely crucial. Second point is that, of course, we needed to reduce emissions. We understand that the climate issue is really a problem. But of course, we had to prove two things. First thing is that we could reduce cost using renewables.
So that it would actually be cheaper for everyone to switch to renewables.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can spoil you in telling you that, in fact, we succeeded to decrease by a factor of two the cost of producing electricity, because now it's very clear renewables are the cheapest option.
And by a factor of two, you mean that the price to generate electricity went down by half?
Yeah, it went down from about $10 per kilowatt hour to about $5 per kilowatt hour. The second point we had to prove is that a power system can work with more than 98% of renewable energy. And this was not clear at all. Even now, many people are still saying that it's not impossible to manage intermittency, because we know solar and wind are intermittent sources. So we have to prove that that was possible, that it was possible to have a combination of different renewable technologies, and this combination bring us the security of supply in all kinds of scenarios. So this was a technical issue that we have to solve.
So there are a lot of answers to this question and a lot of technical answers, but if you had to pick one or two headlines about how you made this happen, what would those be? Why did this work?
In fact, it's very simple. All our power system, all the structure and all the way we plan the system, the way we operate the system, everything, all the structure has been defined according to the characteristic of fossil fuels. And that's not bad, because for decades, they were the best solution that we can have. But if we really want to go to include renewables with all the benefits they can provide, we have to redefine the system. It's not just changing one fuel to another fuel. It's redefining the system. This means new regulation, new way of planning the system, for operating the system, but also the market design itself need to be changed, because fossil fuels, at the end of the day, In order to produce electricity, what you have to do is to pay for the fuel. But when you have renewables, there's no fuel. I mean, the fuel is free. So everything has to pay back an investment. It's a kind of financial business and not an industrial business in the sense of the world. So everything needs to be redefined. And in fact, in a way, we were brave enough in order to understand that we really needed to change everything.
Changing everything, as you have said, this wholesale reimagining of how we produce and transmit electricity, that's a dramatic change, and it happened very quickly. Did you get a lot of pushback from folks at home, from other politicians?
Yeah, in fact, that's very important because in order to maintain the boost for the transition, we needed a political agreement. And in fact, the long-term policy that we wrote, we succeeded to have the approval of all political parties. And this was crucial because the fact of having a long-term agreement which was backed by the entire Uruguayan political system was the panacea for investors. And that's why in a few amount of time, I mean, only 4 or 5 years, we succeeded to have about $6 billion investment. And for a small economy like Uruguay, $6 billion is 12% of the total GDP of the country. So it was a tremendous boost for the economy. We heavily invested in introducing first wind and solar and biomass waste also, which is used to be an environmental liability, and now biomass waste is used as an energy source. So this
It can be debated whether that's actually a green energy source or carbon neutral.
Yes. I mean, overall, it's just a combination of hydro, wind, solar, and biomass waste. And this is 98% of the whole sources. Mm-hmm. So we use water when we need it, not when there is water in the reservoirs. When we have wind and solar, we don't use water from the reservoirs. We only use the water when there is no sun, when there is no wind. So the role of the whole system is to follow the variability of wind and solar. And we still have some fossil fuel plants, but they're not the base of the system. They are just a kind of insurance policy. When all the rest fails, then we use fossil fuels. But this is only 2%. Last year, it was only 1% of the whole electricity in the country using fossil fuels. So that's why I'm saying that we have to redefine all the way the system operates and all the definitions of how power system usually works. And this was the most interesting part of the work.
Ramón Méndez Galán was Energy Secretary of Uruguay from 2008 to 2015. Ramón, I want to get to the very heart of this conversation now, which is, can this approach work elsewhere? Can it be replicated? Because you have named some quite unique aspects of the situation in Uruguay that made this possible, namely that much of the electricity was generated by imported fossil fuels, making solar and wind comparatively cheaper, and also giving a reason to want to promote homegrown electricity. So is this an approach that can work elsewhere?
Absolutely. But of course, not spontaneously. First of all, today, even if you are an oil producer country or a gas producer country, wind and solar are cheapest option. Take, for example, now we're working in Colombia. And in Colombia, they produce oil, they produce gas, they produce coal. But producing electricity using wind and solar is cheaper than using their own gas and coal because technologies have decreased the cost. Because what happened in the last 20, 30 years is that thanks that we will trying to stop climate change, there were incredible development of solar and wind technologies. And so the cost has decreased dramatically. But second point concerning the economy, which is perhaps more interesting, is that when you go to wind and solar, you become independent of crazy fluctuation of oil and gas and coal prices. Because when you have, no matter what kind of geopolitical events you have in the world, an invasion of one country to the other, or no matter what, I mean, this is reflected in the prices of oil and gas. But when you're using sun and wind, they're free. So this is absolutely independent on this event, on these global events. So it's not only that you decrease cost, but you stabilize costs. And this is crucial for the hard economy because it doesn't impact your inflation and to the macroeconomy of your country. So for all kind of countries, going to renewable today is no longer just because of a climate issue. going to renewables today is better solution that we can have today. I mean, take, for example, the case of China. China, they have heavily invested in renewables, not because just of climate change. They have invested in renewables because this is the cheapest option. And half of the total investment last year in renewables were done in just in China. They invested about $7 trillion just in 1 year. And this is because it works. This is because it's the best solution.
Today, you work, as you have mentioned, with other Latin American countries trying to make similar transitions as your country did. You mentioned Colombia. I'm wondering if you've seen progress anywhere near as fast as you made in Uruguay elsewhere.
No, unfortunately, not so far, because in fact, the transition is possible, but we have to change the rules of the game. And we have incumbents, we have rulers, and we have people that have their interests. So changing the rules of the game is not always simple. And when there is a dominant narrative, when there is a dominant structure of the game, which is dominated by a few actors, then going to change in order to benefit other actors is not always simple. So what we work in many countries is trying to show that there is a new narrative, which is not the dominant one, but is the real one. The new narrative is that a transition is the best solution. So, but in order to do it, the politicians have to understand that they need to make changes, because otherwise the market by itself cannot make it.
Ramon, I wonder, in Colombia or elsewhere that does have a oil or gas industry within the country, is pushback from the industry and vested interests, is that one of the challenges of making this transition in a place that has its own fossil fuels, unlike what your experience was in Uruguay?
Absolutely, absolutely. This is one of the main difficulties. But at the end of the day, who is ruling? I mean, because it should be the interest of the people, for the consumers, for the consumer to reduce costs, for the consumer to stabilize costs. I'm not only talking about the households, I'm talking about the industry.
If you were able to give one piece of advice, one sentence, to other energy secretaries out there who would like to do the same thing you did, what would it be?
In fact, these two sides of the same coin. First side is, this is possible. Don't be afraid of that. And this is possible, and this is the best solution. Even if climate change didn't exist, this is the best solution for our own country, national interest. And the second comment will be, you have to be brave enough in order to understand that the present rules of the game has a tremendous bias forcing the continuity of the present system. If you're going to take the advantage of the new technology that has been developed and mature for the last years, you have to change a lot of regulation and you have to change the market design.
Ramon Mendez-Galán is the former Energy Secretary of Uruguay. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for joining me.
You are listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. This week, we've been marking 4 years of war in Ukraine. For many Ukrainians living abroad, Russia's full-scale invasion became a moment of re-evaluation. Fima Chupakin is a jazz pianist from Ukraine, now based in New York. The war got him thinking about where he felt most at home. Last August, The World's Daniel Offman brought us this story of how music shaped Chupakin's life and how the musician relates to the fighting in his faraway home.
When I met Fima Chupakin, one of the first things that jumped out about him is that he loves to laugh, even when I just asked him to introduce himself.
My name is Fima, just like the organization, but spelled with an I. I guess that's my proper introduction.
The other thing that you'll notice is Chupakin's passion for music. That passion, he says, started at an early age.
There was a tiny toy piano in our apartment. I just remember banging on the keys. I'm like, oh, it produces sound. Great. Ah. Maybe I was so annoying that like my mom would like, oh my God, kiddo. All right, let's get him to a music school so he'll be out of the house and doing this, not on a toy piano, but maybe on the real thing.
Chupakin says he doesn't come from a musical family, but his mom, Larissa, liked listening to music at home. Sometimes she would listen to the Beatles, but she mostly listened to pop songs like those by the most famous Soviet pop star, Алла Пугачёва. Миллионы, миллионы, миллион алых роз.
из окна видишь ты.
She would like often sing two of the songs. One was Миллион алых роз. Another one was like, call me, позвони мне, позвони, something like that. So at the time, I feel like that was common for almost every household.
But Чупахин says he didn't just grow up with Soviet pop songs. He says his mom listened to Ukrainian music as well.
She just loved the idea of Ukraine. She loved, always loved Ukrainian music. She would sing, Червона Рута is like one of those songs, aside from Алла Пугачёва, that she would sing rather often.
Червону Руту не шукай вечорами, ти у мене єдина тільки ти.
Чупахин says when he was in music school, he'd listen to any music he could get his hands on. In the early 90s, when Ukraine became independent, and all the way to the early 2000s, he gravitated towards rock. He'd listen to Nirvana, but also Ukrainian bands like Vopli Vidaplyasova.
Весна, 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 весна прийде, весна, 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 весна гамує.
For Чупахин, music became not just his focus, but also a way to get out of Kryvyi Rih, the city in central Ukraine where he grew up.
It's an industrial town, you know, it's like people work at a factory, a couple mines that are still working. It's like dirty, you know, we had like rains that are like dusty, some kind of sparkling dust. That was our rain, because steel factories.
Within that industrial jungle, though, there were some opportunities to break out. Famously, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is from Kryvyi Rih, and that's where he got his start as a comedian well before going into politics. Around that time, when Чупахин was a teen, his piano skills began to rapidly improve.
When I practiced, I would open the doors. So we had a little balcony. We had like a sort of a backyard, courtyard where children hang out, adults hang out, people take drugs, you know, everything. People drink alcohol. Well, entire courtyard would listen to music and they would scream, "Yo, Fima, come on, give us some Queen, man." I think I liked people's attention, and I liked the idea that people enjoyed me practicing, because at the time I started playing a little better, you know what I mean?
Чупахин says that everything he has in life is because of music, and the music took him places. It took him to a music conservatory in Kharkiv, and later, in 2012, it brought him to the United States when he was granted a Fulbright scholarship. By that time, Чупахин's main musical obsession was jazz.
Jazz became like the music that I felt, wow, I can be so free in this music. Oh, and like somehow it had this aura of hipness to me. I wanted to be hip, I guess, you know, and like what was a hip thing, playing jazz, yes.
Чупахин soon became immersed in the New York jazz scene, while also maintaining a strong connection with Ukraine. He'd often travel back and forth. He was always working, teaching, playing live, composing soundtracks, and producing albums. By 2022, Чупахин had been living in New York for nearly a decade. That was also the year when Russia began its full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
We just like started to call all our friends, asking what's happening. And ever since that, I'm like living this kind of like double life that I feel like on the outside, I'm like friendly and smiley and whatever. But like sometimes deep down, it's like it's getting hard because I feel like I'm in this kind of limbo in between.
In between the US and Ukraine, Чупахин says he realized that his life was centered in New York. For about a year, beginning with the full-scale invasion, he said on many levels it was hard for him to function in the US. His mind was always in Ukraine.
Because I physically and geographically live here, it doesn't mean that I'm intending to lose any kind of connections. No, it's actually even grew stronger.
Just recently, Чупахин's band, the Fima Trio, came out with its debut album, called Hymn for the Fallen. This is the title track.
it's my own reflection on what's been happening in my country, in the world, with me. Maybe some of the dreams have fallen. Maybe some of the plans did not realize. But also, so many people died. But not getting too dark, though, this track, to me, it's more uplifting because I believe that whatever dies then grows.
Chupakin says that at this point, many Ukrainians have learned to live with the reality of Ukraine still being at war. Sometimes, he says, it drifts into the background, and yet it's always there. With the release of the new album, Chupakin says he's trying to slow down and acknowledge his sense of accomplishment and think about how far his music has taken him. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman.
Reporter Daniel Offman first brought us that story last summer.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you, as always, for listening.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.